C2A. Number 16B.
So she comes to the sub-sub-tone of truth and shows that heavenly mindedness from the point of view of truth, where she is leading thought first and says, well, if there is no earthly reward, what then is heaven as a heavenly reward? And says, well, you can count on it that you get really a heavenly reward, a righteous retribution. That's the side note there in that paragraph. So she, after having shown that the earthly reward has nothing to do with the heavenly reward, now we give the heavenly reward that we are always rewarded divinely. But she says that naturally a selfish and limited mind may be unjust. You can hear the great sense of justice and mercy is constantly contemplated. We had already on line 9 that God's government is just, and that is heaven. And we already had on that line 9 also mercy. And now she explains in more detail that law of justice and mercy, and says a selfish and limited mind might be unjust, but the unlimited and divine mind. So can you go see, she goes back to the heavenly state of divine mind, is the immortal law of justice as well as of mercy. Of justice as well as of mercy. It is quite as impossible for sinners to receive their full punishment this side of the grave. You see, that's what human justice asks. Human justice says, well, the sinner should get the punishment right away. Huh? He should really be punished right away and put into jail. Usually he gets away with it. So she takes away that whole sense that everything has to be done right away, because divine science knows no time concept, neither time nor space. It only knows laws that are ruling. So it is impossible for sinners to get punished good and plenty on this side, in this world. As it is impossible for this world to bestow on the righteous their full reward. And you see, both sides she's contemplating. We do not have to expect two things. That the sinner gets punished right away, nor do we have to expect that he, through his doing right, is getting the reward right away in this world. That's a human concept of righteousness. That's not the divine righteousness. You know, righteousness is such a big subject in the Bible. Isaiah talks about that human righteousness is as filthy rags. And when Paul took up the Old Testament and began to see it in the light of the New Testament, then his very first big subject that he was writing down in the letter to the Romans was all about that God's righteousness has come, and that God's righteousness is not human righteousness, that God's righteousness is something very different than human righteousness. But that human righteousness is so ingrained in our consciousness that we constantly evaluate and measure everything according to human righteousness, and that's not right. There is a divine righteousness, and here she speaks about that divine righteousness, about the righteous retribution, which says, you know, heaven is not that you get heaven right away for good acts. It is useless, she says, to suppose that the wicked can gloat over their offenses to the last moment and then be suddenly pardoned and pushed into heaven. That's another aspect of it. That would be that we feel would not be right, that they can sin and sin, and then when they die, they are pushed into heaven. Or that the hand of love is satisfied. Now that's the other side of the coin, is satisfied with giving us only toil, sacrifice, cross-bearing, multiply trials and mockery of our motives in return for our efforts at well-doing. Again, both things. He says, well, that's human righteousness if we think that that the sinner can go on sinning and sinning and sinning, and then afterwards he's pushed into heaven. He hasn't had to do anything. And in the same way, it is a false concept to think that one can do right and right and right and only get really sacrifice and cross-bearing persecution. Both are not right. There is a righteous retribution, but that righteous retribution must not be considered in the framework of time, of our lifetime. So he goes on after that righteous retribution and gives the answer through love. Religious history repeats itself in the suffering of the just for the unjust. This is not regarded as heaven. We don't regard that as heaven. That we constantly have to suffer for the sins of the world. But Jesus regarded it as heaven because he saw that is my mission. That's my heavenly mission. I see heaven in the ability to be able to solve the sins of the world, and not only my sins. That's really heaven. That is universality, and not just a limited sense of right and justice. Can God therefore overlook the law of righteousness? Does he overlook the law of righteousness, which destroys the belief called sin? And so Mr. Zeddy goes even higher and says, you see, it's not really sin that has to be destroyed. It's really the belief that there can be sin must be destroyed. If you overcome that, you have heaven. Sins are trillion-fold in the world. Are you going to free yourself of those trillions of different sins in the world, of evil in the world? Are you just going to free yourself of one thing, the belief that there can exist sin? If you can do that, that's heaven. The other is not heaven. The other is battle to overcome one after the other of the trillions and trillions of sins. That's battle. That's not heaven. But Jesus could see the law of righteousness, which said, well, God doesn't overlook that law of righteousness, but that law of righteousness is that we destroy the belief called sin, not sin itself. So if within ourselves we can destroy the belief that there can be something next to heaven, that there can be something opposite to heaven, if we can really destroy that, we are in heaven. We demonstrate heaven here and now. So she ends up with that destruction of the belief called sin. She has started out with the design of love that reforms the sinner. That was the proposition. How do you do that? Through a heavenly state of mind, which finally at the subtone of love comes to see that the law of righteousness, of truth, is of the nature of love, where you see that it is not possible that there could exist something called sin. You destroy the belief that such a silly thing could exist. If there is only one God, then there cannot be something besides God. Always when you come to that, either all or nothing, you touch the tone of love. Love is either all or nothing. It's either the all universe and the nothingness of error. That's always the touch of love. And you see why? Because at that point we don't have to overcome anything. Truth is that which overcomes. Truth is that which destroys. Truth is that which battles with error. Love says, I'm not going to destroy error because I don't know error, so I can't destroy it. I'm not aware of error, says love, so I don't have to destroy it. It's annihilated. It's made nothing. Yes, that was the tone of mind. Is it so difficult? No, it isn't. It is a question that each one asks. Each one asks, I would like to get into heaven. I would like to get the state of heavenly mindedness. How on earth do I get there? And so within ourselves say, well, something has to be changed within yourself. That the plan of love is to reform the sinner. Something has to change in yourself and put right. How do you put it right? How you do get into heaven? How you get there where there is no more sin, nor even sin, where there is not even a belief called sin or a belief called sinner. And you go right through the subtones and begin to see, well, I have to start out with a state of mind. What kind of a state of mind do I have? Do I know mind or don't I know mind? How do I know mind? I only know mind if that mind is at the point of spirit pure, full of pure affections, and I know it through experience of that purity. Then I see I cannot have that purity until I have put away with sin, until I have rebuked sin, until I have gone through the suffering that sin has brought and got rid of it. I have to go through that. And therefore, heaven is not the state that I gain through divine pardon. I have to work it out, principle. And if I see that I have to work it out, I must be clear what my reward will be. Life says you don't get an earthly reward. The fifth day of creation says you have to fly above the earth and not into the earth and crawl on the earth and seek earthly rewards. That is not possible. But you can be sure that truth is always giving a right reward. That you can be sure. That truth is righteous, and therefore it will be a righteous reward. But how does that righteous reward operate? As love, it operates by seeing that there is and has been never a belief in sin. Yeah, that's as easy as that. You see what we do constantly. All this week, we do only one thing really. Just culture the word order, the category of the word order. If one has the spiritual touch of it, of the word, one can adjust really that word order to all the various subjects that one is treating. Yes. We still have time, huh? Yeah. I think it's time that we take up the second subject of spirit. It's a short one, and we can read it in a rather quick way. But before we read it, we always have said we first see what is in the subject, the main tone, what is the first subtone, what is in it? Love here. Love in here is mostly reward, that there is merit in it, and that reward is complete, and that reward is perfect. You get, so to say, the reflection of love as a reward. You see, she has said in the subject of love as mind, she has said, well, there is righteous retribution. So now she takes up and says, yes, if you go along spirit, you get that righteous retribution. The merit is assured. You can count on it. That's the tone of love in it. The tone of spirit in it that flows right through it is a sense of complete reflection that shows itself in complete emulation of Jesus, follow Jesus in all his way, that every child, man and woman, should do it and should reflect it, and that has to be done at all times, and not only by alls, but also at all times. You get again a sense of spirit that is infinitely reflected in time and space. But one also gets really also the counterfeit sense of spirit, namely martyrs. Martyrs are always those that have been persecuted, and persecution was the attempt to hold spirit in the grasp of matter. So the martyrs stand out as those that really link in history the spiritual idea to the next generation. So let us see how she brings out the sense that through our unity with love, really we are stirred to reflect the Christ spirit without measure. That we are stirred, that something within us is stirred up, that love stirs up the spiritual sense within us, the spiritual qualities within us, and that we are stirred to reflect that Christ spirit without measure, which the martyrs all did. They were symbols of that very thing, that they were so full of the spirit that they didn't heed anything, that they didn't mind to be crucified, they didn't mind to be beheaded, they didn't mind to be thrown before the lions, they just didn't mind anything because they were so full of the Christ spirit that is substance, that they didn't mind anything else. So, here we have that from with the seven little subtones. History is full of records of suffering. You get again, the whole thing is, you see, you get here suffering, which is a counterfeit of soul. And you say, why does it start that way? Well, you will encounter that over and over and over, because the overall tone of love says, the plan of love reforms the sinner. And we know that the law of love forces the sinner to give in, and it forces the sinner to give in through suffering. That's why that comes up again and again, because that way of salvation, love, is always a way that takes out the opposite sense of things, the sinful sense of things, and forces it to give itself up in order to accept the heavenly sense of things. So history is full of records of suffering. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. And we get the seed, mind. Mind is always the seed. Those martyrs were the seed that were really stirring up in each one of us. And still today when we think about these martyrs, they stir up within ourselves really the spiritual attitude, the spiritual value. We have great esteem for those martyrs that we say, golly, they really put the spiritual in the first place and the corporeal in the second place. They are really example for us. And one has a feeling, do we have that spirit in us, that Christ spirit moving in us? Would we do that too? You know, always that old question that was that says, well, if Jesus were here, we would follow him, we would throw up the hat and say, oh, here he is, we follow him, we give up everything. and then finding out that we don't, because the Christ has come in a fuller measure than us, Jesus, the Christ signs. Do we throw up the hat and give everything up for it? Have we the Christ Spirit moving us into the nth degree and say, nothing else matters but the Christ science? Well, at the beginning of the Christian Science movement, that was very much the case. They were so imbued by the spirit of what Mrs. Edith was were teaching that they really could drop their job and say, okay, finished, I open up a Christian Science practice. They were telling every people they didn't mind to be considered ridiculous and so on. They had still that spirit, that Christ spirit within themselves that moved them to bring forth the idea of science. Yes, so they were the seed of the church. There it starts. As long as we naturally just go back and stay in the chapter on prayer and stay in the closet and stay in the closet where nobody sees anything of us, where nothing happens, then nothing will happen. The prayer is the beginning, but not the ending. The prayer is the beginning that says to Atonement and Eucharist, get going, get going. Even if you have to become a martyr, take it on you, get going. Mortals try in vain to slay truth with the steel and the stake. You see, the counterfeit of spirit that mortals try to stop the Christ spirit through material means, through steel and the stake, but error falls only before the sword of truth. So these martyrs really were swinging the sword of truth, and they said, our fight is spiritual, your fight is carnal, but we fight and we will win. And actually they did win. They always say, I don't know how true that is, but I can believe that is true. They always say that nothing impressed the Romans at that time, who were really heroes, strong soldiers, where only the muscles were counting and the sword was counting, warfare was counting, bravery to be a hero was counting, that they were impressed that these Christians that could sing songs and rejoice when the lions were eating them up, that impressed them as being a hero, that they considered then actually the Christians as being greater heroes than they were. And with that, the Roman Empire fell. So we don't have to belittle those martyrs. We think, well, wouldn't there be a way out? If they would have shut their mouth, they wouldn't have been brought to the lions. Wouldn't that have been a way out and so on? Well, there would not have been a siege, and perhaps the Roman Empire wouldn't have fallen so quickly. Yes, then we come to a little subtone of spirit. The martyrs are the human links. Now you get the order of spirit. They were the human links, which connects one stage with another in the history of religion. In another way, somewhere in some unpublished notes from Mrs. Eddy, she compares really the martyrs with telephone posts, posts that are linked with a wire to the next post, and where the message goes right through history and through the centuries, down the centuries, that these martyrs are like telephone posts. They were those who were linking to the next development. As she says it here, they are human links, really, in that history of the idea. They are Earth's luminaries, mind. They are Earth's luminaries, mind, which serve what? To cleanse and rarefy spirit. They began to cleanse and rarefy. Just as I have said with the Romans, they began to stir in the Romans that they say, my golly, there must be a power above our muscles and above our swords. There must be a power that is much bigger, which we don't know. So it stirred them. So the purity of spirit is necessary to cleanse and rarefy the atmosphere of material sense, and to permeate humanity with purer ideals. Can you see that purity comes up always in spirit? With purer ideals. So consciousness of right doing brings its own reward. Can you see? She goes back and says, in mind as truth, she said, the reward is assured. There is righteous reward. How do you get it? First, she says here, you must be moved by the spirit and must have pure ideals. Then such consciousness of right doing will have its reward, but not amid the smoke of battle. What is the smoke of battle? The battle of spirit, where we are in the midst of a crisis, of a depression, of a frustration, in the midst of chemicalization. In that midst, which is the counterfeit of spirit, is merit. So it says, but not amid the smoke of battle is merit seen and appreciated by lookers on. So it shows that those martyrs were really showing forth a wonderful Christ spirit, but they were eaten up and torn to pieces. They could not, perhaps in the middle of the battle, the lookers on could not really see what impact they had on the whole history of mankind. See, we can't say, well, they were eaten up and what a pity, but how wonderful they were. They were singing songs and glorifying God and so on. We must see the bigger value of them. They were really like these telephone poles, starting a message that was running down the century up to now. We still live by their courage, by their spiritual courage. We still live by it. If they hadn't been, Christianity may have got lost. So it needed first somebody who was willing to be a martyr and stand up for the truth, no matter what the price was. Then we get a sense of soul for this Christ spirit that moves us. When will Jesus' professed followers learn to emulate him in all his ways and to imitate his mighty works? Can you hear the tone of soul? Soul always identifies itself. Here the term is used, emulate, imitate. That's the very same thing as identify it. To do the same, you see, identity means that one does the same, that it is the same, that subject and object is the same. Do we do the same, she could have said, as Jesus did? Do we emulate it? Do we imitate his mighty work? That's the point of soul. Those who produce the martyrdom of that righteous man would gladly have turned his sacred career into a mutilated doctrinal platform. Can you see what she says? What is the subject? They would have liked to overturn it, to turn it to the opposite, the counterfeit of true translation. They would have liked to turn the right into the wrong, to turn really what that righteous man has done into a mutilated doctrine. Can you see? Soul, that we emulate him only then when we do the same and not when we reverse it and translate it wrongly. That's a mistranslation. May the Christians of today take up the more practical import of that career. Take it up, that practical import. Do the same. Identify yourself with it. That's the point of soul. Yes. The hour is over. So we go on this afternoon with the rest of the talk.